She was as easy to crack as a raw egg. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast proposing a toast to community property. Now, you'll regularly hear it said by cinema doommongers that originality is dead, as Hollywood today is only interested in reboots and remakes. But the reality is it's a phenomenon that's as old as Tinseltown itself. Since the very earliest days, movie moguls have been retelling and redoing old films. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. John Huston and Humphrey Bogart's iconic take on the Maltese Falcon was in fact the third version of that particular story that had been brought to the silver screen. Obviously, the crucial question for anyone involved in producing a remake is how do you improve on the original? And the obvious answer for anyone listening to this podcast is you include an exploding helicopter. So on this show, we're looking at a remake of a golden era Hollywood film, is 1990's Narrow Margin. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who should be arrested on a 314. With me once again is my good friend Nick Rehack. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. How are you, man?
I am very well, and I am very excited because I'm glad that you could join me on this particular episode, because the film we're featuring here is one of the most important exploding helicopter films in history. And if there was anyone, if there is anyone I wanted to tackle this with, it was you. So, do you feel up to this challenge, that, you know, taking on this epoch-making moment?
I'm kind of nervous now, but yeah, man, like, let's, I'm excited now. Like, I'm in my, when you said that, in my mind, I'm like, okay, I wonder if this part makes it historic and important, but I'm like, now I'm not sure. So I'm really, really curious now as to what we're going to touch on later.
Okay. Well, no spoilers here at the top of the show. We'll get into all of that later. But Narrow Margin, the film that we are tackling here and talking about, is a remake. And I know people can have very strong opinions about those. I mean, I've got a friend of mine who is completely against remakes of any kind, and I think it's very easy to knock remakes as a sign of, you know, creative bankruptcy, but, you know, I don't want to get into the discussion of this film by moaning about remakes. So what I wanted to ask you at the top of the show is there a remake that you think is actually an improvement on the original?
I really like, as much as I'm very hit and miss with the Coen brothers, if I really, really like their films, or I can't stand it at all. But one of them that I really like and think is better than the original is True Grit, their remake of the John Wayne Western. And there have been many a holiday family get-togethers where I've been berated by, you know, older uncles and, you know, older distant relatives and everything, telling me that I'm crazy and how could I ever, Jeff Bridges can't hold a candle to John Wayne, that movie is perfect, and blah, blah, and all this other stuff. But for me, there's something about the movie, it just stands out, and I think it's better in every facet and an improvement in every facet over the John Wayne True Grit.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't, when I was thinking about this question, posing it to you, that one hadn't popped into my head. I can't say I am a particular fan of the original True Grit, and I'm really not a Coen Brothers fan, as anyone who's listened to me podcast will know. But I'd probably say I'm in the same camp to you. I probably prefer the Coen Brothers version of that film, although it's a while since I've seen either of them, so I think I'd want to refresh my memory before coming to a definitive verdict on it. But I think that True Grit, I think that's actually a Coen Brothers film that's probably, if I had to rank them, that would probably be one of the ones that I like the most or dislike the least. I don't think they're that's as good as you'll get from me about the Coen Brothers. They just, look, I'm not here to convert anyone to my view. They're just, something about their films just doesn't chime with me. If you like their films, all power to you. Go out there and enjoy them. But there's just something about their work that has never really sat right with me.
Yeah, for me, it's Big Lebowski is perfect, one of the best ever. No Country for Old Men is solid. Then there's True Grit, and then everything else. Like, I think Fargo is terrible. I don't understand the love that it gets. Like, I... Again, it's very extreme with me. It's either I'm really into them, or get it away from me. I want nothing to do with it.
Okay, well, let's stop talking about remakes that don't have exploding helicopters. Let's instead talk about one that does. So let's talk about 1990's Narrow Margin. So let's hear the plot of the film be sketched out in a series of sound bites.
You seem edgy, Michael.
No, you don't understand, Liam.
Don't be afraid. I would never harm you.
Well, Michael, I lied.
The woman was in the other room. She saw everything. Everything. Nobody knew about her, and they still don't.
You were a witness to a murder, and we'd like you to come back and testify.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't think you realize the situation you're in.
I'll take my chances.
You get on the train and lock the door.
Those two guys, they got automatic weapons.
They've seen me. They might not have seen you. They might not know what you look like.
How do we stop him?
We don't. It's not going to take him very long to find his compartment.
This is my life we're dealing with.
Grab the handrail! Get on the roof!
Gene Hackman.
I have to make my move before they make theirs.
Ann Archer.
I'm scared standing here.
Sometimes the difference between life and death is a narrow margin.
A Los Angeles district attorney attempts to take an unwilling murder witness back to the United States to testify against a top-level mob boss. Frantically attempting to escape two deadly hitmen sent to silence her, they board a Vancouver-bound train only to discover that the killers are on board with them. As the train hurtles through the isolated Canadian wilderness, a deadly game of cat and mouse ensues, in which the ability to tell friend from foe becomes a matter of life and death. Narrow Margin stars Gene Hackman, Ann Archer, M.M. Walsh and J.T. Walsh. It was directed by Peter Hyams, who had a very long career making thrillers and action films in the 70s, 80s and 90s. Most notably Time Cop, the 2001 sequel 2010 and End of Days. He's best known to exploding helicopter fans, though, as the man who directed the excellent conspiracy thriller Capricorn 1 and Sudden Death with Jean-Claude Van Damme. And he also wrote the script for the Charles Bronson thriller Telephone, which also featured an exploding helicopter. Now, as we've alluded to already, this was a remake of a 1952 film with the same name. If you're not familiar with that film, it was an RKO B picture directed by Richard Fleischer that's now come to be regarded as a bit of a classic of film noir. Narrow Margin 1990 has a 6.6 user rating on IMDb and a 3.3 out of 5 user rating on Letterboxd. So with all of that out of the way, Nick, what did you make of Narrow Margin?
I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine. I felt like it lacked something. There was something about it that it was missing. I can't put my finger on it. But I felt like Gene Hackman was there and he was in it and everybody's doing their part. Like it's well cast. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's just something about the film that's missing. I think it's genuine tension, because as the film progresses, I never really get a tense moment. I never really get a moment of like, oh, they're not going to make it, or oh, like there's never any doubt that creeps into my mind where I don't know where it's going to go or what's going to happen. And I think that kind of takes away from the film for me a little bit, because I want to enjoy it. I want to be on the edge of my seat and tense and wonder what's going on. But when I don't have that there, I find myself like starting to check out a little bit. I'm like, okay, they're just talking about coffee, or okay, they're just doing whatever. Like there's nothing really intriguing and grabbing me to keep me there. And I was a little disappointed by that.
Yeah, I can understand that a little bit. I mean, I find it hard to be terribly enthusiastic about this film myself. I think it's a good film. I think it's a solid film. It's very efficient. It's very well done. There's a lot of craftsmanship on display, as you say, like, you know, got some really good actors in this, and the acting is all like super solid here. Do you think, you know, in terms of the fact that you are a bit lukewarm on this film, I mean, do you want it to be bigger? Do you think that would have helped with it? Because all of the action in this film, it's fairly grounded. It's fairly, like, the situations are fairly believable. You know, if you found yourself stuck on a train trying to smuggle a witness from location A to B, this is kind of how it might actually sort of play out. There's no sort of Superman heroics taking place in this film. So would a grander production, a grander scale, would have that helped things for you?
Actually, I think it's more the opposite for me. I think I wanted it to go smaller. I think I wanted more of like a tense game of cat and mouse instead of just walking past each other and like blatantly knowing what's going on. Like, I know you, you know me. There's nothing we can do about it until we get to a different point in the train or a different point in the trip or a different state or just something. But there's never that ongoing tension. I feel like if it's somehow made a little bit smaller, a little tighter and more tense, maybe some more engaging dialogue, there's got to be something there that can keep the momentum going without having to change set pieces. I mean, they even break it up a little bit. There's a scene where the train comes to a stop, everybody can get out and stretch their legs, and the tension amps up a little bit because it's like, okay, now we're going to introduce a larger setting. What do our characters do with this? How do they play with this? And they make some good use out of it, and I think it's one of the better moments in the film. But when we're on the train, I feel like there's a lot that could be done and explored, or there's ways to amp up the tension of like people almost being caught and it's not done. So I think if you could somehow shrink it down and make it tighter and more confined, I think you might have just a better end product.
Okay. But I mean, there is a bit of a battle of wits that takes place within this film. I mean, you get that business. I mean, it's not on the train, admittedly. There's a scene that takes place whilst that train stopped at the station, and Gene Hackman pulls that little ruse in the toilet cubicle. I really enjoyed that particular scene because it's such a bit of a fresh spin on a very, you know, stale like movie trope where somebody hides in a toilet and somebody's like looking under every toilet cubicle to see where somebody is hidden. And, you know, Gene Hackman's pulled that little ruse by taking his trousers off.
They did get me. And I do like the fact that they kind of cut to one moment and he's just kind of in his boxers. Like, they, you know, they really went through with it. I did like that moment. But I don't know. I feel like Gene Hackman, as good as he was in the film, like, he was just a little too cocky. He was so confident the whole time that it's all going to work out, it's all going to be fine. There's never that moment where he's like weary or he falters, I feel, where he like falters. There's not that one moment that puts doubt into our minds as well. And instead, it's just kind of like, he's got it, it's going to be fine. Because most of the time, that's how it pans out. It's everybody else around him that kind of falls by the wayside and runs into the problems that they do, and not him. And it's just like, I don't know. I guess I wanted just something a little more out of it. I wanted more tension somehow.
Now, as I've mentioned, this is a remake. So when I was putting together this particular episode, I thought it'd be interesting to get you to go back and watch the 1952 original so that we could do a bit of a comparison. Now, I must admit to being a bit of a film noir buff, and the 1952 version of Narrow Margin is a film that I like quite a lot. So I've been looking forward to introducing it to you and seeing what you made of it. So, Nick, what did you make of Narrow Margin OG?
I thought it was great. I had such a good time with this movie. When I saw this, I was like, oh, man. I'm like, if the remake is half as good as this, we're in business. Because there's something about this movie that there is an immediate tension there. Because we don't really see why the person is in the predicament that they are.
Mm.
We just have all these facts and this hearsay, and there's something that they're after, and it's got to be big. So in your mind, you're thinking of just how crazy and how big this really goes. And then you have like the bathroom fight sequence, out of nowhere. I'm like, in the 50s, we're having bathroom fights like this that are really intense.
Yeah.
It's
a really brutal fight, isn't it?
For
that year as well.
It really is. And like the way the mirror's breaking, I'm like, what is happening right now? And I feel like even the people, the staff on the train were just so much more invested and so into it. And it felt real, unlike the train staff in 1990 Narrow Margin, where it felt like actors. Mm. Like, I feel like with the 1952 version, it almost feels like they genuinely filmed on a train and they just used the staff that was there and just like, just be normal. Just be, you know, do what you would normally do.
Well, there's an extra dynamic to that original version of Narrow Margin, which is lost in the remake because they decide to switch up a few things, which is in that original version, the dynamic between the police in that film, it's a police officer who's escorting this witness from I can't remember what city back to Los Angeles, but there's a real friction between those two characters. She's this, I mean, there's a great description of her. She's this sort of gangster's mole, and she's described as a 60 cent special, cheap, flashy, strictly poison under the gravy. And she really resents the police officer who's played by Charles McGraw. And all he's trying to do is save her life because there are these men on this train trying to bump her off. And they change that dynamic in this film here so that into a bit more of where Ann Archer, she's just more sort of, she's just sort of scared and she's just, you know, concerned about her own safety. And the dynamics between Charles McGraw and Marie Windsor in that original version, just much more interesting than the 1990 version, which is, I guess, you know, they were trying to change some things, do things a little bit differently, but that one was definitely not a change for the better.
I agree. I can appreciate that the 90 version made a couple changes and there are some adjustments to different reveals that happen. It keeps it fresh enough to where it could kind of pass for a different movie altogether if you changed one or two plot elements and like backstories. And I can absolutely appreciate what they did. But like you said, it works. The one in the 50s just works. You have this woman who is steadfast and she's like, look, I know what I got to do. I don't want to do it. I think it's stupid, but fine, let's do it anyway. And then you have this detective who's kind of unsure of himself because of everything that's been going on. He's in a situation that, you know, he should have had a partner and a partner's not there. Now he's just kind of going by the seat of his pants to figure it out. And I think that adds the tension that we're missing. In the 90s version, we have these characters that are, you know, one is just so unsure and wavering and they should be confident. And you have this other person that's overly confident when they should be like kind of scared and wavering. And you don't really get that. It doesn't come through as strong in the 90s version. It doesn't work as well. And there's something about the way that the 1950s version is shot. I think it would have been neat to see the 90 version in black and white, but there's something about 1952 and being in black and white that I think just kind of adds and elevates. And maybe it's because, you know, here it is 2023 and we're looking at a film 71, you know, years ago. And maybe it adds like some of that like old Hollywood nostalgia, like you're talking about film noir and stuff. Maybe it adds a level to that, but I think it's also a visual that the 90s one was missing and it just didn't capture.
Well, you mentioned that the 1990 version could almost be a different film, and that was actually a charge that was leveled against it by the director of the original film, Richard Fleischer, who was still around in 1990 and was not a fan of this new version, where he said that the only sort of similarity between the two films was the title, and that the only difference was that his cost $188,000 to make and this one cost $20 million. And but there are quite a few things that are retained between the two films. So you've still got the fat railroad cop who that's a reveal. You've still got the mother and kid that you have in both versions. And there's still that sort of business proposition scene where you get the kind of the gangsters trying to persuade Gene Hackman to take some cash and give up the gal.
Yeah, there's a couple lines of dialogue that some are word for word, and there's also some that are like a word or two is changed, or they kind of change instead of a phrase that would have been used in the 50s. They kind of updated a little more modern slang to it, and I thought those were nice and like good decisions. But there's just I could do without, you know, knowing what she's on the run for. I think keeping it secret and keeping it. That keeps you invested. Like, wow, they're really after her. Like, what the hell is she involved with? Like, what's really happening? And you see what's going on in Narrow Margin, and you're like, there's so many different things that could be done. Like, there's so many different ways to combat what's happening, and it doesn't... I don't know. There's just some... There's an excitement in the 1950s version that's missing from the 90s version.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
Tom Burton, ex-CIA, armed and dangerous. And when a hostile nation commits a desperate crime.
My son's been kidnapped. I'm told that you're the only man that can help me find him.
A beautiful woman will do anything to save her son.
If you find him, you'll be financially set for the rest of your life.
Why would you trust him? The Emir's got his own little world out there.
And he needs weapons to defend it.
Now, Tom Burton is the only man alive.
I'm coming with you. My son is going to be in the middle of all that danger. I'm going to be there too.
Who can do the job.
We're going tonight. Take him by surprise.
And do it right.
And how can we be certain that there are casualties?
We usually take scouts as receipts.
Because to win this war... Tom Burton must wage a desperate fight for freedom.
No!
Get the girl and the kid and get back up here.
Rutger Hauer, Carol Alt, Omar Sharif, and Elliot Gould star in a powerful tale of passion, intrigue, and betrayal. Beyond Justice.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs early in the film, after Hackman and the doomed M. Emmett Walsh use a helicopter to fly to the remote cabin where Ann Archer is holed up. Unbeknownst to them, they've been followed by baddies in another chopper. When they arrive on the scene, they open fire on the cabin, as well as the other helicopter, as it tries to make a getaway. Damaged by the gunfire, the wounded Whirlybird spirals around out of control before plummeting to the ground and exploding. Nick, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
When it started, I was like, okay, like we're getting it early. It was very exciting to get the exploding helicopter action early, because that doesn't happen a lot in films. A lot of times it's like the big climax, or it's in like the last 10 minutes and you've had to sit through a bit of a slog, but it's up front. I'm thinking we're going to set a tone right here. Maybe there's a second one later on. There wasn't. But the way it kind of goes down, I'm like, oh, it's not going to be too much of anything. It goes straight down, nose first. And I'm like, I've never seen that before in a film. Like, that's pretty wild for it to go straight down like that, big explosion. But one thing I noticed, they did some weird editing, because it looks like it's a helicopter flying around, and then they cut to like a remote controlled helicopter that's supposed to be painted to look like a real helicopter, and then it cuts back to the helicopter that they're blowing up. Maybe it was the film, like the version I saw, but it looked like real and then super fake and then real again. Did you get that at all, or is it me in my eyes?
No. You weren't imagining anything. There is definitely a switch to a model helicopter for like a couple of seconds. I don't really understand why they do that, because it's not as if the helicopter is doing anything in that moment that you couldn't get a real helicopter to do. So it was a very puzzling little moment within that particular sequence. And, we'd have to ask Peter Hyams as to quite why that shot is inserted into that particular sequence. But you mentioned the way in which the helicopter plummets to the ground. And as you say, it just falls. It just like nose first into the ground. And that is an almost unique fall from the way in which that falls from the sky is almost unique. We only get to see a helicopter fall like that in one other film, And that is the Jean-Claude Van Damme thriller, Sudden Death, which was also directed by Peter Hyams, the guy behind this film. So it's almost like his director's trademark.
Interesting. See, I like that a lot because it's not, you don't see that all the time. For it to just go a nosedive straight down. Usually it's whirling out of control or just explodes in the air. But no, it just goes straight down. Beautiful fireball when it hits the ground. I'm really digging like the dark, dark reds and dark, dark oranges. Like it just seems like a much darker explosion. But again, and I can't stress this enough, or I keep repeating myself, but it goes straight down. And you just don't get that.
Like, no, it is very, very unusual. That. Yep. I completely agree. It is,
big,
yeah.
Plume of smoke afterward. It was really beautiful explosion, but it's straight down.
Well, there are only two in history, and both of them have been directed by Peter Hyams. So, yeah, whatever else you say about his career, he's got that as one of the strings to his bow. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this is a hugely important exploding helicopter, and that's because this chopper fireball, along with the truck and helicopter chase that takes place afterwards, has been reused in no fewer than five films. So
what?
The exploding helicopter has appeared in a 1999 film called No Tomorrow, Mindstorm from 2001. It's also been in Crash Point Zero and Time Lapse, which again were all from the year 2001, as well as turning up again in Badass 2 Badasses with Danny Glover and Danny Trejo from 2014. So for that reason, this particular exploding helicopter is one of the most famous, one of the most seen, and one of the most iconic exploding helicopters in film history, Nick.
Like, they just reuse it? They just reuse the scenes?
They just reuse the scenes, yeah. They just kind of clip the footage. Obviously, where Gene Hackman or M.M. Walsh are visible, mm-hmm. and they just they clip them into the film. I mean, the most amusing one, Nick, which if you happen to ever watch Badass 2 Badasses, as I mentioned, it's got Danny Trejo and Danny Glover in, and they also as well as using the exploding helicopter, they also reuse the kind of the truck chase through the forest. Now, in order to kind of make that work, because obviously this film came out in 1990, and Badass 2 was from nearly 25 years later. The truck that is featured in the film is obviously really out of date, so they have to make an actual specific plot point in Badass 2 of Danny Trejo and Danny Glover getting this very old truck. Like they actually remark on it, like, oh, what's this old cruddy truck you've got us, because it's the only way they can match the footage by having them actually be in possession of this ridiculously out of date vehicle.
That seems like you made that up. I know you didn't, but it really does. Everything you just said seems like you made that up, because who reused, of all the exploding helicopters in existence, this is the one you're going to pull from? Now, I get if it's like a scene where they're at a diner and they look over their shoulder and this is on TV and you see it like on a TV hanging from a wall and, okay, we get it. They're watching this movie. But to reuse the exact scenes, that blows my mind. That absolutely blows my mind.
I think it's because I'm guessing that it is a sequence that is very easy to edit round in, like I've just described with, Badass 2, that there are enough long shots or mid shots that don't show enough detail that you can kind of then film some other stuff, and you can kind of then meld the two, sets of like the old footage with the new footage, and you can kind of make it seem like a coherent sequence, because obviously that scene takes place out in this wilderness, this forest. So, as long as you've got your characters out in a forest, it'll match up, and there's no skyline or there's no other sort of billboards or anything that would give the game away as to the age or the date of this footage, or mean that it doesn't match up with any other stuff. So I suspect it's those qualities which mean that this particular sequence has proved so fertile for filmmakers who want to insert an exploding helicopter into their film on the cheap.
I gotta watch this badass film now, because that sounds so insane to me. It just sounds so insane, and your logic is sound. Absolutely makes sense. There's nothing that would, outside of the vehicle, show its age, but that's insane to me.
Well, there's a few other things I should probably mention in terms of the exploding helicopter. The helicopter that blows up is one of the most blown up helicopters in film history. It's the Bell Jet Ranger helicopter. This is a Gene Hackman vehicle in many ways, and Gene Hackman's been in a few exploding helicopter films over the years. He was also in The Domino Principle, which features an exploding helicopter, 1970s conspiracy thriller. Gene Hackman was in Superman 2, which features a very good exploding helicopter, and he was also we should really do this one on the podcast. He kind of does an early version of Rambo. Gene Hackman leads a mission back to Vietnam to rescue some POWs before even Sylvester Stallone was getting in on the act. He did that in Uncommon Valor from 1982, I think. And when we were discussing on the last podcast actors that you don't expect to be in exploding helicopter films, and I don't know whether you'd put M. Emmett Walsh in that category, but
I would, yes.
Well, I mean, but even he's been in a fair few number of exploding helicopter films. I mean, as you should remember, Nick, he was in The Final Countdown, that time travel movie that we watched for the podcast.
Oh, come yeah, on. He was on one of the ships, wasn't he?
He was.
Everywhere.
He was. And he was also in a Dolph Lundgren film called Red Scorpion, where a helicopter blows up. But I was also thinking about remakes and that feature, like Narrow Margin, that feature an exploding helicopter where the original doesn't. And there's another 1950s movie, this time the sci-fi classic The Day the Earth Stood Still. When they remade that with Keanu Reeves, they put a couple of exploding helicopters in it. Unfortunately, that definitely, nothing could frankly improve that film enough over the 1950s original. We've been talking about remakes that try to improve on the original by including exploding helicopter. Well, there is actually a film that has an exploding helicopter in the original version, but then doesn't have it in the remake. And
what? Who would do such a thing?
Well, it was I can't remember who directed it, but it's the remake of the George A. Romero movie The Crazies. I think that came out in 71 or 72. When they remade it in 2010. They neglected to put an exploding helicopter in it. And nobody seems to think that's better than the original. So I don't know what that ultimately tells us.
Well, it tells us the person that was making that film was crazy. How do you not have that helicopter in there? Like, what?
I don't know if it's possible from this discussion to conclude whether including an exploding helicopter in a remake makes it better or makes it worse. I mean,
well, I think
we have evidence to the contrary and evidence in support of this theory.
I mean, it's looks like there's a lot of movie watching to do.
I think what we need is a bigger sample size here. We need a bigger sample to work with before we can come to a definitive. It's just too small a number of films, so more data is needed. I think that's the answer to that question.
I think it is, and I think you're just the guy to do it.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Nick, thank you for joining me once again. Before we go, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Yes, rabbitholepodcast.com. That's where you can find more of me if you're so interested. I'm over on the show with Bubba Weed called Lyrical Innuendo, where we take a look at some music lyrics and determine what they're really singing about. And there's also Play MST for me. Jason Soto and myself are watching every single episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000 ever. and talking about them. So come join the adventure over on rabbitholepodcasts.com.
As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website at explodinghelicopter.com. If you want to follow us on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd. We'll be back soon, but until then, what should people do, Nick?
Keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters. This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Know what I like about you? You're tall.